Hello, everybody. This is Sam Williamson. We are here for a conversation with Tim Tews. Gary is co-hosting with me, and we're going to be talking with Tim. Now, Gary and I met Tim at an online calling course that he participated in beginning this summer, and then we got to meet him face-to-face at a base camp gathering just a month ago or so. And it's just been really a delight to meet Tim. Tim is a man who's overcome a number of difficulties in his life and disappointments and setbacks. In fact, as he and I were talking about preparing for this conversation, he said sort of a theme of his life has been James 1, 2, you know, where it says, "Consider it joy, my brothers, when you're involved in various trials, because you know that the testing of your faith produces an endurance. And when endurance has its full effect, you'll be mature, complete, lacking nothing." And Tim said, you know, that's sort of been the story of his life, is God giving him some things to endure, but it really having taught him a whole set of things. So, Tim, it is just so good to have you with us. I've been thrilled to meet you, and been looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you.
You know, Tim, when you and I were talking, you began by just talking about some difficulties in your own upbringing, living at home outside Chicago. Could you just talk a little about living at home, your father, and expectations?
Sure. I was born in Minnesota and lived in Minneapolis for a year and then in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin for 2 years, but primarily growing up from age 3 to 22 in the Chicago suburbs. And I was kind of under the false impression that I didn't know it then, but I thought I was living a normal life. But I knew that there was something not quite right about it, but I just thought that it was what was to be expected from life. And the dilemma was that I was being fathered in a way by two different men, my dad and then my mom's father, my grandfather, maternal grandfather. And they just, the way that they had dealt with me was just very, very different. I felt just extremely loved unconditionally by my gramps. He was just an awesome man. But with my dad, it was a situation of he was a teacher and he was a firstborn like I was. We're both the oldest of our generation, and it was a situation of growing up under extreme performance oriented lifestyle. And because I was the oldest, there was just a lot of expected of me, and just the way that they responded to me was, both my parents, was really harsh.
So how would your father express that, sort of setting a high expectation for you? And what would be the consequences if you didn't meet it?
Well, he would, basically, he'd beat me. He would scream at me, and one of the things I found out years later was, discovering what the father wound was, and mine was he would call me a lazy asshole, and he did it when my mom wasn't around. We couldn't even say fart in our house, but he'd hit me, he'd slap me upside the head, and then sometimes, it would be this thing, looking at a report card and then saying, why didn't you do this? And look at this, and look at what's happened. And then even years later, when I was playing football, I had a great day, and he took me out in the front yard and had me blocking up against a tree to show me how to do it right. But it was, he would sometimes, too, then kid, he would take a swing with his hand, and like he was going to slap me upside the head, and then bring his hand around and scratch the top of his head like he was kidding. And so, and I would listen to things like, in my house, I'm king. And it was always end of discussion. If I tried to ask, or tried to defend myself, I was never allowed to voice an opinion. But it was always this mix.
You're not talking about situations where you start a fire in the living room or you take crayons and write all over the wall. You're talking about just sort of normal behavior. You got a B instead of an A.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's actually the truth. I was a B student much of the time, and the irony is that my dad, he was a teacher, And he taught auto mechanics for the Chicago City College system and a local high school for a while before that. But he never would go over homework with me. But there was this expectation of, why didn't you do better? It was always just, and the big thing was that he was always angry. It was any time he was around, he was just driven in his own personal life and just had that expectation for me. And in fact, the way that I grew up, I felt like I was an impediment. It was like an obligation. I did not feel like a son to him.
So contrast this. You're talking about your grandfather, your mother's father, your maternal grandfather, just sort of being an ocean of love. So
yeah.
When did you see your grandfather? What was your reaction to the sort of the dissonance between the two?
Yeah, well, a little bit of background. My dad grew up from a dairy family north of Milwaukee, and he was fourth generation, and he broke that tradition in the family line. But they weren't super wealthy, but they had a lot of money and could do what they wanted in that family.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas on my mom's side, my granny and my gramps, and they were up in Minneapolis, they were very blue collar. My grandfather was a truck driver, and he worked for a company called Dayton's, a parent corporation for the Target stores. And my grandmother, she was worked in retail sales too. After my mom had left the house, and my mom was an only child, so he didn't have a son of his own. But I grew up like a son, and so what would happen is I would see him from Chicago to Minneapolis. Sometimes I'd fly up on my own or take a train up on my own. And I had a younger sister, 2 years younger, and we would go up and spend a lot of summertime with them. And it was just, I mean, we weren't allowed to have, we called it pop then, we weren't allowed to have soda, at my home. But up there, they just, like, sort of broke a lot of the rules, just like, I remember root beer floats and popsicles and just... the point wasn't what we got to eat. It was that they wanted to make us happy. And so I would go off fishing and shooting with my grandfather, and he had a reloading bench, and he made guns, and he carved violins, and he had a dark room. He carved violins, yeah. He made about 25 in his lifetime, in his spare time. And he would, but he would cast his own bullets. He'd go and dig them up. We'd go to sand pits in the summer, and we'd scrape out spent lead and literally melt it down. And he made his own molds to make bullets. And so we'd cast bullets and then reload them and make black and white prints. And
so he's taking you completely under his wing. I mean, he's given you soda pop. He's given you root beer floats, but he's also just teaching you how to do stuff like.
I'm working with band saws and lathes at like 8 years old.
This is like little 8-year-old heaven.
It was nirvana. It was unbelievable. But then it would be this moment where at the end of the summer, at the end of a long stay, it would be this thing of if my parents had come up to pick us up, my sister and I, my mom and dad would drive up from Chicago, and then we'd drive back, and it would be literally we get in the car. And I can remember this vividly, sitting in the back seat, and my dad just turning around and slapping me over the back of the seat into the head and saying, "Quit your crying. Don't you upset your mother." And I would be bawling because I'm leaving my beloved grandparents. And it would be after this amazing, it might be 6 weeks with them. But the transition was that stark. It would be from joy to basically you're a piece of shit.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Sorry about the language, but that's pretty much how it was.
Would you be afraid when it was getting close to your parents picking you up? I mean, you're sort of having this nirvana experience, and you know that. In 3 days, in 2 days, in 1 day, and in 1 hour, your dads are showing
up.
Yeah,
after a couple of years, you kind of knew that it was going to happen. And it literally, I didn't know it then, but it was killing my spirit. It was, it would be something that I, you know, you, for me, when I would hear, you wait till your father gets home, it'd be like, holy crap. You know, it would be, I don't want to be anywhere near him when he gets home. And it wasn't that it was always that, 100% of the time, but it was, let's say 70 to 80% of the time, he was just, really angry. And then you can imagine too, that it affected my mom, and I don't want to disparage them, but you know, it's, I remember my mom too. She'd grab me by the arm, and she had long fingernails, and when he wasn't there, it was like she'd step in and you know, dig those nails in. And I remember one time she drew blood with those nails. Yeah. And so it was, but mom was knew how to love me at times, but it was like with my dad. It was, he never said he loved me, and never apologized when he was wrong, which I thought was a lot of the time.
So, so you started the conversation by saying you thought this was normal.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, something must be going on inside you where you're with your grandfather, and you're filled with love, and someone taking you under his wing and sort of showing you how to be a man and do things, and then you're probably just scared being around your father. What's going on inside the little 10-year-old Tim Two's head?
Well, you know, the funny thing is too that I my parents were Christians. They always took us to church, and then, you know, and an irony is years later my dad became a deacon in our congregation. But I was aware of God at age 3, and I think that you know, you'd hear about how God is good, and for me it would be, I hated church. I hated the confirmation program they forced me to go into, because it all reeked of it being a lie. You know, I did not believe that, because of what happened with my dad, I didn't believe that God loved me either. And so what I think would happen is, for me, I would look for love in just any place that I could, and that, I guess affirmation, and that manifested it as I got older, and I got a bigger repertoire, a bigger basket of goods to reach into for that affirmation. I basically, it was like everything became an addiction to me, and I just thought that's.
Talk a little bit about football, because, I mean, football must have been one of those things where you got affirmation.
Right. Well, as a kid, I'd always, because of basically my hero, or who's supposed to be the hero, my dad, being a bully, I was pretty much unafraid of people bigger than me as long as they're about my age. I was always afraid of older men in particular, but older boys, and boys my age, I had not a lot of fear of. So in athletics, that was the one thing I found out from playing like sandlot baseball in the neighborhood and keep away on the playground at school. I realized that I was good, and because older kids would want me to be on their team, and
so
the other younger kids
were not
wouldn't.
Intimidated by the bigger kids, and
not
you
at all.
That.
I actually enjoyed it. I felt like I'm going to compete with them.
Mm-hmm.
And be peers with those older guys.
Which gives you affirmation, the thing you're looking for.
Yeah. And so what ended up happening was, over the years, I was in track and wrestling, baseball, but and swimming. And I did really well in grade school. I was going to say that I excelled at that. And I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but as a seventh grader, I was the only seventh grader to make the eighth grade wrestling team and the eighth grade football team and swimming team. And that carried into my freshman year. In football, I've been playing for, you know, flag football for years, 2 years of tackle in seventh and eighth grade. And then, but my freshman year was a really great year. It was kind of a glory year for me, where we had 66 guys go out for the team, and I was starting. I started on offense, and I started on defense, and I was a tackle at that time, and also an outside linebacker. And then I was on two of the four specialty teams. So literally, every week I'd only like miss like one or two minutes out of a game. And again, we had 66 guys. It wasn't like there was a shortage. And so it built me up. That was my freshman year. And that gave me a kind of a false sense of identity, but it was what I could rely on. It was people knew me, and it was the one thing that I really felt like in Chariots of Fire, where I felt God made me to play football. And I thought at that time, even as a kid, I thought, I'm going pro. This is who I'm going to become.
So how long did that last?
Well, there was what ended up happening is that summer between – I ended up playing for part of my sophomore year and then my junior and senior year as well. But what happened between my freshman and sophomore year that summer, I was – and at this point I'd been gone through confirmation and I'd had this experience where God said, I want you to be a minister, and the day I was baptized – and that kind of freaked me out, and I kind of, nobody talked to God that I knew of, so I never told anybody. But I didn't like the idea of wearing a collar, so I pursued football. I'm thinking, I'm not gonna be, you know, holy. I'm just gonna play football. But that summer, 1975, I was riding a 10-speed bicycle and rode down a hill. And long and the short of it is that I couldn't see around the corner until I got up on the into the intersection and was hit by a woman driving a Cadillac, driving about 55 miles an hour, and she broadsided me.
On your bicycle?
I'm sorry?
On your bicycle?
On my bicycle, right. And I landed about three houses down, and I was in the hospital for about 20 days, and I just fractured vertebra, broken nose. My hip was, pelvis was fractured in three places, paralyzed wrist for about 10 months. And the result of that was that afterwards, it didn't matter how hard I tried. First off, it was a long recovery. But afterwards, I could just spend hours and hours and hours doing things that I had done pretty much with ease prior to that, and I couldn't compete. And I went from being this captain and looked up to, even by older guys in the high school, and now I'm like third string. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that happened, too, is that from that moment on I stopped growing, and so I was no longer one of the biggest kids. I was just average, and I was an average athlete, and that's kind of where things got sour with God. They turned for the worse at that moment.
Hey Tim, let me ask you, how did your parents react to your accident? How were they with you after the accident? Were they closer to you, more involved, or distant, or what?
No. It's funny you're bringing this up. What ended up happening with my grandparents up in Minnesota, we had to, I was told not to tell my grandmother, my granny, because it would upset her. And she would be, you know, instead of being nurturing and come down and take care of me, and she's retired at that point, they both were, I had to hide it for decades. We didn't bring
for
it up.
Decades?
Decades. I was in my 40s when I finally talked to it was probably about 2000 and let's say 2003 or so after my gramps died that I finally told her what had happened. But I had to hide it from her. My gramps knew, but my dad went out and he bought me a new bike, which was really kind of cool. But he was still working like a dog to be, you know, he had this American dream and this ideal of what he needed to do to be a man, I think, and what he needed to provide. And so it was, again, he was kind of angry because it was, now they had to file insurance claims and it was like, okay, now these are all the problems and this is what I'm going to have to do to fix it. But it wasn't like, how are you, son? Never happened
right.
That way.
So did you really feel, I mean, was your feeling sort of like you're just one more nuisance, one more hassle in my parents' life?
Absolutely. I was just another hurdle. I was just another obligation. I was just one more box on the to-do list. And it didn't make him happy. I mean, I think that he was glad that I was alive. I must say that my mom came and she hung out at the hospital during the days with me, spent a lot of time with me. That was so mom was pretty cool about that. But my dad, he was not there. Yeah. And by the way, he wasn't at my football games growing up either. I think I remember 2 games that he ever showed up to. And the one that he did, I remember, was like Father Sunday, and it was like, you know, he's like, you stand out, you know, they call your dad's name, and I just remember at that point being really embarrassed. You know, I put this false smile on, looking happy, and I was not. I was thinking at the time, you don't deserve to be here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So here is someone who's sort of just taken had the rug taken out from underneath them. I mean, you're getting affirmation at least from being able to play football, and all of a sudden you're not able to be successful to the same degree that you had been. What
right.
is your reaction? What do you do with your life? Because you're not getting it from your dad. You were getting it.
Right.
You were getting some of it from being able to be successful at football and, you know, applaud
right.
and acclaim. What are you doing now?
Well, I'm sorry, what am I doing now?
Yeah, I mean, what is your response at that time?
Yeah. What ended up happening was in grade school, during my early teen years, I was kind of awkward looking and I had a nickname of Frog. And it was one of those things that killed my spirit because Dad abused me and my mom would be abusive from time to time. Local neighborhood kids would kind of tease me about my looks, and then that carried over into school. And so the point I'm making is that with girls growing up, I was always very, very, very insecure. But then as I got older and started getting into athletics, girls took an interest in me. But one of the things that I'd always said to myself, I didn't do drugs, wasn't drinking. And I had girlfriends, but I always said I'll never cross that line. Why not? Well, because the Bible tells us so. And I actually had gone to a pastor and asked him about premarital sex, and he said, "Yeah." I asked him, "Why shouldn't we?" And he said, "Because the Bible says we shouldn't." Well, after that, I had a girlfriend. And who'd actually been asking me about getting high. She had an older sister that was influencing her, 3 years older, and also she was having sex with her boyfriend, and so this my girlfriend was actually pressuring me about it, and I always said I'm not going to do that. And then after the accident, what ended up happening was I ended up becoming an atheist. I made a deliberate decision and said, God, if this is your version of love, if this is how you love me, I don't believe in you anymore. And I gave myself permission to do anything. I started swearing. I didn't drink too much. I didn't like it. But I started getting high, and I started having intercourse with my girlfriend. And it was like a Pandora's box for me.
Okay, so what I want to do is fast forward a minute, because at this point you're in high school, but when you turn, I don't know, I think I remember 21 or 22, you end up moving to L.A., is that right?
Right, yes.
And there, a couple years later, you come to the Lord, and you now are dealing with some guilt about sort of, because if I recall, with you and your girlfriend, you ended up having abortion together.
Well, yeah. Well, I'll back up a little bit. What ended up happening was at age 16, I got my girlfriend pregnant, and it was 1975. It was 2 years after Roe versus Wade, and it was something that I hid. We hid, my girlfriend and I, from her parents and from my parents. And it was a huge, it was a shaming thing. And I remember driving down to a clinic from the suburbs into, took a train into Chicago to check this place out. And I was just barely 16, and just at an age where we could hide it legally. But what ended up happening was, fast forward about 4 years later, after high school, I ended up I was in another relationship, and it turned out it was my girlfriend's best friend, and she and I ended up having a relationship, and she was going to pursue a professional dancing career. And she said, "You want to go to? I'm either going to Los Angeles or New York." And I said, "I'm done doing cold." And so I ended up, we ended up moving to Los Angeles together, and we lived together there for a year. But before we had gotten there, we were college age at that point. I think I was 20. I might have been 19, and I got her pregnant as well. And so there was a second abortion. Now, you'd asked about in Los Angeles, I lived with that second girlfriend, and she went home for Christmas after about a year of being there, and called me up when she got there, and she and we fought all the time, and it was not good living. And she called up and said, "Yeah, I said, when are you coming back?" She said, I don't know when I'm coming back, and I don't know if I'm coming back." And at that moment, I was so angry. I did not want. I had a terrible breakup with the other girlfriend prior to that, a couple of years before, and so I just became cold-hearted. I hung up on the girl, and there was a woman that had been hitting me up at work for a long time. During that year, and I remember basically getting together with that girlfriend or with this woman at work, and ended up living with her. So I was bouncing from relationship to relationship.
And again, just all looking for affirmation and validation. You're sort of You're looking to feel good about yourself.
I am, and they were very complimentary about my looks. And instead of, you know, the old nickname, and being interested in me, and then the funny thing is that I really had nothing to offer. The truth was, maybe looks when I was younger, and maybe I was nice, but it was almost devious in that what I was really interested in was sex. I cared about them, but I got comfort like a drug out of sex. You'd asked about, what ended up happening was I was working for a manufacturing firm, custom architectural products, out in Los Angeles, and there was a woman there named Lynn Kellogg, and she would preach the gospel to me. She knew what I was doing. She knew the woman I was living with, who happened to be the office manager, but she would preach the gospel, and she would just say, "What are you doing?" What ended up happening is I had ended up breaking up with this office manager, which was very painful. And the reason was that that woman, she knew that her brother had muscular dystrophy, and she knew she was a carrier. And she said to me, "If I ever get pregnant and it's a boy, I'm going to abort it." And even in my state, fallen state, not walking with the Lord, there was something about it that was just so heavy for me. It was like I couldn't do that. And I was thinking how callous of her. And so that relationship ended with the office manager. And then about a month and a half later, this woman that had been witnessing to me, she was talking about this place called The Vineyard, and I thought it was a coffee house. out in Anaheim, and she'd say, "Yeah, and sometimes we, and I knew it was a bunch of Christians, and at that point I used to call them the beautiful people. There were some Christians working in my plant for the wife owner. She had a nonprofit called...
Just a minute. I'm going to interrupt you a minute.
Okay,
because
sorry.
We've got about 10 minutes, and we got about 2 hours worth of stuff to cover.
Yeah.
So if you don't mind, sort of see if you can just do a synopsis, you know, sort of coming to the Lord and then moving to Colorado, because I also want to sort of talk a little bit about just your last year or two of your life. So...
Synopsis is, so I ended up, well, I went on a date with this woman, and I had an experience with the Holy Spirit. There were 5,000 people there, and in it, and the Holy Spirit basically said, I am what you have been looking for your whole life. It's not sex, it's not drugs, it's not the kind of car you drive, the clothes you wear, the job you have. It's me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a humbling moment, because I, at that point, had been making fun of Christians. And then what ended up happening was I worked for the company for 11 years. The owner of the company called me, said I was like a son to him. I was promised part ownership of the company. And in the end, his wife died, and afterward, he remarried a younger woman, and she took the company over, and I was left basically out in the cold after 11 years of service and being their number one employee. And then during that period of time, I ended up engaged to Lynn for we had dated for about a year, and we had a huge age difference. She was 16 years older than I was, but she ended up in the midst of that introducing me to Cynthia, my wife, and Cynthia and I think we got so that was 1984 was when I became a disciple of Jesus. And then my wife and I, we ended up getting married in, I think it was 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And we were living, we lived up in the San Fernando Valley. Well, actually, we were living down the beach, and we kind of moved around a little bit, but ended up living up in the valley. And we attended
I'm going to interrupt you and just cut to the chase on this a minute. So
okay. My
memory is you ended up starting a remodeling business, restoration remodeling business.
Well, yeah. After I didn't know what I was going to do, and I ended up going back to school for 4 years, and I got a business degree at about the same time the Northridge earthquake happened. And what ended up happening was I realized I hate business. I can't stand business. But I knew renovation growing up. And so I started a remodeling renovation with a partner, and then went off on we did that for a year, and then we went off on our own for another 2 years. And at that point, I was taking care of three grandparents or assisting them. My grandparents had retired out in California desert, and so I'd drive out. It was 100 miles round each way. And then her grandfather, Cynthia's, and all three were in their 90s. My father-in-law, who is he was a Hollywood television writer, was alcoholic, and so he was hospitalized four times in about 5 years right after I graduated. And we were really active in the church, and so what ended up happening was I ended up having a severe spine injury and had surgery, and that was in about 2004. And as I'm laying on my back, my wife walks in with this pregnancy test, and I'm stoned on opiates, and she says, you know, it's Father's Day next Sunday. And I said, what? What are you talking about? And so at age 45, laying flat on my back, I found out that I was going to be a dad for the very first time.
And your wife and you have been married for 15 years at this point, 10 years?
18 years.
18 years.
Hmm. 18 years. And the first 8 years, we had my wife had a couple of surgeries. We had seen two infertility specialists. And at that point, I thought God was punishing us or punishing me because I had killed my babies.
Hmm.
And it wasn't until I became a disciple that I understood what I had done. And like Paul, I have broken every commandment, and I knew it. And so for me, when my daughter Avery came into our lives, it was a major deal. It was as though the Father was saying, I trust you. And you might not be able to tell, but I couldn't talk for I couldn't talk for a day. And that's a huge deal.
So now what you've done is you're in California, and you and your wife and your daughter decide you're going to move, you're going to go from good to better. You're going to move to Colorado. You're going to get out of L.A. You're going to be in a better environment to raise your daughter.
Yeah.
You can't do the renovation business anymore, so you've moved to Woodland Park, Colorado.
Yeah, and my father-in-law had died of alcoholism and cancer, and then both of our grandparents, mine and hers, had died, and we felt that it would about 10 months after Avery was born, it was the height of the real estate market in Los Angeles, and our house was worth a fortune. And we'd always said if we ever had a child, that Cynthia would stay home. And she'd had this career in advertising as a copywriter. And so she and had a good income from that. And so we knew that we would lose that income. Plus, I was injured and didn't know what was going to happen. And the surgery wasn't doing much to make me feel better. And I was living on two narcotics at that point. And so we made the decision to sell the house. And we checked out a couple of different states and local areas, and then ended up deciding to move to Woodland Park above Colorado Springs. And that was in 2005, I think it was October. And thinking, yeah, life was going to be really grand. And what ended up happening was I thought I had a great marriage. I was told I had a great marriage by a pastor who said he had counseled 350 couples over decades and said, you guys are the best marriage I ever knew about, and I didn't know it, but the anger that my dad had transferred in a way onto me, and I was didn't know it, but I was basically being an asshole to my wife, and we grew apart. And so thinking that it was going to be this great situation, we had a lot of money at the time, that it was going to be good, and my wife, her parents were both gone, and we weren't getting help, didn't have friends here. We didn't have a solid church like we had the rest of our marriage, and she felt alone. And one night, about 2:30 in the morning, told me, you know, if it weren't for our daughter, I'd divorce you, something that we promised we would never threaten. And that was a shock. And now I shut my heart down to my wife because I was betrayed by my wife. And it was very hard to live that way. And then what ended up happening is so we moved there in 2005, October. What happened in February of 2011, during a routine exam at my general practitioner, he was feeling around in my abdomen, and he felt a lump. And he was pushing in my abdomen and said, do you feel this? And I said, no. Long story short, it turned out to be a massive liposarcoma that was 16.5 centimeters by 11 centimeters by 14 centimeters. And they were estimating that it weighed between 8 and 10 pounds. And it rocked my world.
It weighed how much?
They estimated at the time between 8 and 10 pounds.
Okay. So you've got something in your stomach that's the size of a football almost.
Yes. And ironically, I'd gone from when I had the spine injury, I weighed about around 212, and I was down to 168 pounds, and I had that tumor in, and I had a six-pack abdomen at that point, and you could not tell it was there. It was completely hidden, and yet it filled about a third. If you look at it in cross section, it filled about a third of my abdomen.
So now, if I remember, this is not just cancer. This is a particular virulent kind of cancer.
Yeah, liposarcomas. What happens is, again, with the large dimension, 16.5 centimeters, when they become 10 centimeters or greater, the life expectancy is half die in 5 years. And so since 1984, I've been walking with the Lord. And I remember reading the first study I read. It was about 10 o'clock at night. My wife and daughter were in bed together. And I remember reading this study, and I had probably 50 studies to go through, and that was the first one. And I remember just weeping and looking at them and thinking, oh, God, how could you do this? You give me this miracle, and now you're going to take her away. And it was walking with the Lord was really hard at that point, because it was, my wife doesn't like me, my daughter doesn't like me, and now God doesn't like me, and it was, that's the way I looked at it.
So that was 18 months ago, a little over, maybe 20 months ago.
Yeah.
What has happened to you? I mean, you know, in some ways, you started with a passage talking about rejoicing in various trials because of God training you in your faith, testing your faith. What have you learned in the last 20 months after coming through, you know, it's really such a horrific experience?
Yeah. Count it all joy, my brethren, for your various trials. It was a passage of scripture I memorized in confirmation, and I hated memory work, and I hated that passage. And I've always, you know, I've threatened, it's like, man, I am, when I get to Brother James in heaven, I am going to bitch slap that dude. Just that it is, you know, if you want to count your trials joyous, go for it, but don't you talk to me about that. And I was really angry at God too. I remember being in the, when I had surgery, I went through, by the way, I had two surgeries, and they removed a whole bunch of organs and this tumor. And then I went in for emergency surgery. I had radiation and then a really, really horrific chemotherapy. But I would say to God, I remember one night during the second surgery, the emergency surgery, my abdomen is filled with 4 liters of bile. And I remember my side and this massive scar, and I was thinking, God, you have no idea what you're doing to me and what this is like. You've tortured me. And it was like the Holy Spirit reminded me of Jesus and the spear in his side, and reminded me that if I died, it wasn't just for my sake or my life that would be losing, but Jesus died for us all. And it was a humbling moment. And I had been having nightmares up to that point. And I won't go into it, but just that I thought the angel of death was in my room 3 nights in a row at about 3 or 4 in the morning it happened. And so what God's been doing, though, is just over the, we ended up finding a counselor who was just this amazing. She was a nurse, and she had dealt miraculously. She was cured of cancer, lupus, and MS, and just spoke with the words of the Spirit to me. And she would say things like, be still and know that I am God. And all of a sudden, my heart opened up for the Lord. And through this process, the verse, count it all joy for your trials, is totally making sense to me. I don't know how, but the Father's been walking with me and telling me and reassuring me through all the people that came to our aid, literally hundreds, people that were on our Caring Bridge site, literally tens of thousands of people have hit and prayed for us. And the love that was shown for us just reflected the Father's love. And so where my heart is now is I'm starting to appreciate the trials. I didn't understand why he, like C.S. Lewis said, calls him the cosmic sadist. And that's the way that I grew up thinking, you know, when's the other shoe going to drop? And now I see that this whole time he's been preparing me and giving me something to share and to talk about. And it's joy. And when I teasingly say, every day, you know, somebody will say, how are you doing? And now I say, it's the best day of my life. And the reason is, any day that I can wake up and see the sunrise is the best day of my life, because I don't know how much longer I'm going to live, but it's true. And so I have this, the other thing I say too is that one of the side effects of cancer was God gave me a heart of thanksgiving. And I've never been a thankful person. I've always been really resentful and bitter, and God has just blessed me to show me how much I actually have to be thankful for, and that he loves me. as a son, a beloved son.
Tim, I'm really struck by this theme that I'm starting to piece together here. There were many times when you talked about things being completely hidden, like your first girlfriend's baby, completely hidden. No one could tell. You could go to the abortion clinic, you know, completely hidden. No one would know. You have this accident, and that's completely hidden from your grandmother. Have a bad marriage. Well, drug abuse, completely hidden. You have a bad marriage. It's hidden. The pastor thinks you have the best marriage he's ever seen. This anger of yours is kind of hidden to the public. The tumor is hidden. And there's just this hiddenness theme in your life. And yet there's also this, you know, kind of revelation light coming in and exposing. And there seems like there's a new lightness to life that comes to you all of a sudden. There's a this theme of hiddenness is, I hadn't seen it before when I heard your story. But now it just appears you, as you're saying now, you live in this, nothing's hidden anymore, right? And why hide something when you don't know if you have the next day? You just live in the day. It's a remarkable story.
It is, Tim. And, you know, what I like about the story is you're sort of, in the end, the real redemption of all this. You're sort of being able to say, God, I just trust you, and I rejoice in this. Even though you don't quite understand it all, it seems to me that you have spiritually an incredibly different disposition about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. So. Yes. Well, the other thing that strikes me as well as we're wrapping up this call is, as you also talked about, Sam, is when you said in the beginning, Tim, I thought my life was normal because my life is all I knew, and I was just struck by that is so true for all of us.
It is.
It takes someone else to say, you know what, you're feeling like that? I don't feel like that. That's not normal. Or this is what happened with your parents? That's not normal. Or, I think we just go so trapped in the isolation, that then makes us think that our life is normal, therefore we won't change anything about it. I just think that happens in every realm, physically, maritally, relationally, spiritually, physically. Very struck by that as you talked about that.
So, Tim, I just want to thank you for being so personal and being honest about your life. And I think it's good for all of us to hear this and to hear another brother's story and journey and to understand that there really is life. God is working in all of these things to bring us to life. The end of the passage that you talked about is so that we may be mature and complete, lacking nothing. Mm-hmm. Now, this is James 1:4, that we may be mature and complete, lacking nothing. And there's some way that in the most difficult stuff that we experience, God is doing something that's beyond our imagination. And I think that you've done a great job sharing your life and giving a good example of that. So I just want to thank you. I know everybody wants to thank you for your being personal and genuine and honest with all of us. So thank you.
Yep, thank you, Tim. And it's just like Sam said in the beginning, you would really need hours to really tell your story, which wouldn't be available for everyone to do on the phone. So thanks for even giving what you gave in this short amount of time. It really was. It was a gift. It was a blessing. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Tim.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Okay. Good night, everybody.
Yep.
It's just been good again to be together in Base Camp in the Secret Garden, sharing together our lives. Thanks.
Yep. Good night. See ya.
Good night.